We are recording, and welcome to Hetaireia Hellenes Greek Club. We're reading in the narrative of Matthew, and we are at verse 8 of chapter 2, which is kind of in mid-sentence. So we'll just pick up there. This, of course, is the story of the Magi. And so we'll just get started. So verse 8. Kai pemsos autus eis Bethlehem apen. Poruthentes ex etasita acrobos peri tu pai deu. Epande hureta op angela tamoi. Hapos kago elthon proskuneso auto. This is introducing the direct speech of Herod, who in verse 7 accurately, you know, found out from the Magi when they had first seen the star. And then in verse 8, Matthew continues and introduces what he says to them. The first participle there, pemsos, is from pempo. That's pretty easy. It's a weak aorist. Following the pattern of lusos. And you always have to make a decision, you know, when you have a participle like this. The referent is the unexpressed subject of the main verb, apen. So it's he, all right? And sometimes it seems in context to be worth the trouble of translating it temporally or causally or something like that. But I think this is a good example of something we've already seen before in Matthew's narrative sections, namely just what Bells calls the bang-bang participle, or Wallace calls it the attendant circumstance, piggyback.
Piggyback. Yeah.
So just, he sent them into Bethlehem and said. So like, after he sent them, he said. Well, that doesn't make any sense, actually.
Because they'd be gone by the time.
Exactly. He needs a cell phone. That's right. Which is in the first century, everybody's like me. That is to say, not owning a cell phone. So we'll just take it as bang bang. He sent them into Bethlehem and said. And I actually want to take this next participle in a similar way. Poruthentes is from poruomai. It's a passive deponent. So it literally means going. This is the same participle, by the way, as in the so-called Great Commission. Going, make disciples. But I think you can actually argue that in both places, it's just kind of piggyback. There's not a particular emphasis on going, but you just kind of have to go in order to accomplish what the main verb says. So here, they can't inquire in Jerusalem. They have to go and inquire. So if we take that participle then, poruthentes, in the same way, then we'll just translate it matching the mood of the main verb, which is from ektasso, which means to inquire. And it's it's from ex etasso, and it's an imperative, aorist imperative active second plural. So go, comma, inquire akrobos, adverb, accurately, about the child. And then epon, you'd have to look this one up probably. It's not that common in the New Testament. It's just a temporal conjunction, and it takes the subjunctive verb. So when or whenever you find heureta, that's the aorist subjunctive active of heurisko, and the giveaway as to the mood of the verb there is the long connecting vowel, the eta. So whenever you find, and you supply him, it, ap angelata, announce to me. This is from ap angelo, the liquid stem verb. So the stem changes. This is actually the aorist imperative, active second plural. So announce to me for this purpose, hapos, plus the subjunctive. In order that, kago is just kai plus ego, also I, literally, coming. And then proskuneso would be the aorist subjunctive active first singular. It has the same stem as the future, proskunes, But here, because it's in a clause headed by hupos, it'll be a subjunctive verb. So, the purpose, in order that also coming, I may pay homage or obeisance to him. And by the way, you can pay homage or obeisance to someone in the dative or the accusative. Here we have the dative. Daniel Wallace, in his fine grammar, tries to make a fine distinction between proscuneoing someone in the dative and proscuneoing something in the accusative. And he's a real smart guy, of course, a lot smarter than I am, but I think that fine distinction doesn't actually work out all that well. As I think we mentioned last week, historically, it's hard to imagine that Herod is saying that he's going to worship, you know, with a capital W, the child, just as the wise men, the magi, are probably not intending to worship the child in the full sense of the term. Nevertheless, we can, without going into theology, we can kind of see this as a foreshadowing of the Gentiles coming, you know, to worship the Christ. But again, that's theology, and Lord knows we don't want to do theology in a Greek club, right? Yeah, questions about verse 8.
Yeah, wouldn't Herod be one to be worshipped? I mean, the way that the Romans held their kings to be gods, almost. And
well, yes, and
so
again, I wouldn't push the deity thing too far. And the cult of the emperor is kind of just getting started at this point. And usually, I don't know if this is good or bad, you only get worshipped after you're dead, right? So yeah, I think historically, pay homage, show respect, something like that is probably a better translation. Good. Other questions about verse 8? Anything at all? Okay, good. Forging ahead, verse 9. We start with this little change of subject construction, which is the article plus de. So it's probably not, hoi is not governing akousantes directly. It's when you look at it, you might want to translate it, but those who had heard the king. And that's possible, but, you know, Matthew likes, as the other evangelists do, he likes to shift subjects by pronoun de. So we'll take the hoi there as a pronoun and just translate they. And they, and here you might actually give the participle, aorist, active, a kind of a temporal force in the context that seemed to make good sense to me, after they had heard the king. The verb akouo can take either a genitive or an accusative object. And it can also take a huti clause. It can also stand on its own. So I don't think there's any sort of difference in meaning between hearing someone in the genitive or hearing someone in the accusative. I think it's just kind of a stylistic variation. So here, tu basileos is actually the object of the participle. So, but they, after they had heard the king, eporutheson, kai edu, I forgot to read it in Greek, ha aster han eidon ente anatale pro agen autus heos elthon estase ep ano hu ein ta paideon. So, but they, after they had heard the king, journeyed or went, and now we have the second idu. Now, again, in Matthew, at least, not so much in Mark, but Matthew likes this little word and he uses it to mark structure or emphasis. So if you look up at 2:1, we have the first surprising thing, namely, magi show up. They're the least people you'd expect to be willing to pay homage to the new king of the Jews. And then I think that St. Matthew is being very deliberate in verse 9. It's not that hard to get from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, right? I mean, any idiot can find their way from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, and I'm not just any idiot, you know. But Matthew wants to mark this. So, and look, the star, and now we describe the star with a relative clause. Han is the relative pronoun, accusative, because it's the object of its own verb that is eidon. Remember that accusative and relative pronouns function in their own clauses. So the star which they saw en teonatale, in the rising, when it rose. A pro agon, this is from proago, and the temporal augment lengthens the alpha to eta, and it's an imperfect. It's not an aorist. So I think we can translate, began to go ahead. Again, I suggested last week that at least one way to read the narrative is that they saw the star, they packed their bags, they headed to Jerusalem, they got close enough for government work, and then they start asking where the guy is, where the newborn king of the Jews is. So the star was not, I'm suggesting, was not visible to them the whole time. Right? But now it, in a sense, reappears, and it began to go ahead of them. Until, heos, and now we have another participle and a main verb, until coming, estathe, this is from histeme, and it's actually the aorist indicative passive, right? It has an active intransitive meaning. So not was stood, but simply stood. Okay. Until coming, it stood. Epano is just an adverb that, or a preposition that means above. Literally, where the child was. Two little words there. Who, literally is the genitive singular relative pronoun, but it comes to be an adverb. Just this form itself, who, and it means where. An adverb of place. And the little word ein, which you might recognize, is actually the imperfect of a meh, third singular. So again, putting that whole last part of the verse together. It began to go ahead of them until it came and stood above where the child was. Okay? And at this point, the children's choir begins to sing,
yeah,
"We Three Kings of Orient Are," or something like that. Even though they're not kings, and we don't know that there were three of them.
Yeah, or that
that's okay.
Orient,
let them
even
sing it, Ben. Don't go busting into that new congregation and forbid the singing of "We Three Kings of Orient Are."
Do it right after I move the baptismal font.
Right.
Right. Gaspard, Melchior, and
That's right. That's right. Any Greek language question about verse 9. It's a great story. So, pretty straightforward in a sense. Anything?
The variant and este pain.
Yes.
Este.
Yes, este. That is just the strong aorist indicative active of histeme. So it would translate the same way. Yeah. The estathe is actually kind of an odd-looking form. I'm not sure how often the aorist passive of histeme appears. But it's a possible form. And you probably don't remember this because you don't need to. But histeme actually has two third principal parts that are both active. There's estain and estesa. And they're both available. And they actually have a difference in meaning. One is transitive, the other is intransitive. If you want to look this up, it's actually in Belts. What is chapter 35? Is histeme? Yeah, exactly. It's one of those at the end of summer Greek where you're just kind of learning how to... You're just not paying any attention now. That's right. That's right. That's right. So, yeah. Good. Good. Anything else? So there's probably just a stylistic correction. You know, the scribe sort of instinctively wrote the easier form, probably. Something like that. Good. Okay, verse 10. Idontes detan astera echaresan charan megalein sphodra. Very dramatic and emphatic statement. The participle is aorist participle active from horao. Adon is the third principal part, and then you drop the epsilon to get the non-augmented stem of id. The referent, it's a nominative plural. The referent is the implied subject of the main verb, which is ekaresan. So it's the they, namely the magi. And you probably would give this a temporal translation, when they had seen the star, right? Or maybe even a causal translation, because they had seen the star. And then Ikarisan is actually, believe it or not, that it's from Cairo. I actually looked around with this verse a little bit. Apparently some principal parts are active and some aren't. This is actually the aorist indicative passive from Cairo, but it's a strong six principal part, so there's no giveaway theta eta. It's just an eta. Just, and Dan is shaking his head going, give me Hebrew any day, right? So although it's aorist passive indicative, it just translates as an active form, just they rejoice. And now we have this, it's called a cognate accusative, they rejoiced a joy, right?
Yeah.
And not just any joy, but a big joy.
A big joy.
And then to make a little more, even more emphatic, sphadra is an adverb that means exceedingly. And exceedingly. I think this is actually the same way, this is the same adverb as Easter, where they're really afraid. Where the women are really
great
afraid.
Fear,
yeah, exactly.
So this is, they say that they rejoice in exceedingly great joy.
Exactly. Okay. The King James actually gets it pretty good by making it that, it's a little redundant, so it's emphatic, right? So the Magi are just minding their business, toiling on their way to Bethlehem, and then the star helps them out, as they say in southern retellings of the story. So, but grammatically, pretty straightforward. So just pushing on then into verse 11, which has a lot of participles, most of which I think we can take as attendant circumstance or piggyback. Kaiothantas eis tein oikian, eidan tan paidean metamarias teis metrasa tu. Kai pesantes pros ekinesan auto, kai an oixantes tus thesarus auton, pros enenkan auto dora, chryson kai livanon kai smyrnon. Sorry. And coming into the house, notice that Jesus and his mother are in a house now, right? Not in a manger or something like that.
Really?
And we will get into the historical problem. And when they had come into the house, they saw the child with Mary, the mother of him. That's easy enough. And, now another participle, this is from pipto, the third principal part is epezon, so this is aorist participle active, and it's, again, it just flows, it's the nominative plural implied subject of the verb paid homage, and they fell down and paid homage to him, and, once again, participle followed by an aorist, they opened the treasures of them, their treasures, and pros enenkan. This is from, believe it or not, anybody?
Pharaoh.
It's from Pharaoh, right. It's from pros Pharaoh. This is, and Edding is over here starting to slit his wrists with his little big pen, you know. Yeah, this is from pros Pharaoh. It's aorist indicative active, third plural. By the way, it's a strong aorist stem, and it has a weak aorist connecting vowel. So, go figure. It should be an omicron, but it's got an alpha, and Satan just likes to do that. They offered to him, and now the object is gifts, and now we have in apposition to gifts, accusative object, we have three accusative enunciations of the gifts. Gold, chryson, and of course we know what it's supposed to say, but if you look up Libanos, it means frankincense, which is a kind of a rosin that comes from a particular plant, and it's very aromatic, and it's, you know, valuable, and so forth. And Smyrna, here, the accusative Smyrnon, is another rosin. It's interesting, the lexicon calls these both rosinous gum. So I wondered how it would sound if we, and they brought to him gold and chiclets and dentine. But, Ben, don't move the baptismal font and don't translate it that way. Okay? And to be honest, see a fairly recently published commentary, I don't think the gifts stand for anything. If they do, you can't tell what they stand for. The one connection that can be made, I think, is that they are gifts that you typically bring to a king. And there's actually a link to the Song of Songs, of all things. And so, it's possible that these are gifts that are appropriate not just for a king, but for the Davidic king.
So myrrh doesn't have anything to do with the fact that he's going to die? Or
Well, if it does, you can't show it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the problem. So, and it's really funny to read the history of the interpretation of the three gifts. Sometimes they are Christological, sometimes they're virtues, you know, like wisdom, prudence, and self-control or something like that. It's an interesting study to show how these things are variously interpreted. So
somebody said they're all things you can find in the temple.
There's lots of possibilities. So anybody who's interested can work up a 10-page paper and present it when I'm not around. Right. But grammatically, it's pretty straightforward, right? But in a sense, historically, what would you expect? They're coming to find a king, right? Now, a divinely appointed king, to be sure, and in some ways, a king that's worthy of the Magi leaving their former beliefs behind. I mean, really, it's very unlikely that the Magi are here. They're a bunch of pagans. But they've actually come to pay homage to the king of Israel. And that in itself shows that God has revealed to them, you know, that they should come and pay homage.
And you're even saying that in his lowly status. I mean, they still get, you know, they're coming to see a king.
Right.
I would imagine in their minds they're thinking something grander.
Of course.
And they come here and they see the baby in a house.
That's why they need the star.
And they still get the gifts.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, Luther thought that Mary and Joseph used the gold to pay for the flight to Egypt. Right? But that goes beyond the narrative. So we'll just keep reading. Okay.
I thought the flights to Egypt happened before this did.
That's another problem. See a recently published Big Blue Book. Right?
I think Dr. Berlioz is the only one that got that right, but I'll explain later.
That's right. That's right. Verse 12, and that'll finish off the paragraph. Once again, we have participial construction followed by a past time indicative, right? It's just very common. Once you get the hang of it, these, you know, aorist participle, aorist, or imperfect indicative. It's just kind of a narrative pattern that you see a lot in all the Gospels, maybe least in John. Verse 12, Kai crema tistentes kat anar, me anakamsai pros he rodein, de ales hadu an e koresan estain koran auton. So krematizo is not that common. You probably had to look it up. It means to impart a divine revelation or warning. And it's passive. So hence the translation, being warned. A familiar translation. And I think here, again, since it's a attributive position, we can give it a causal sense. And because they had been warned, according to a dream, not to return, anakampto means to return, to Herod. Notice that the infinitive anakampsai is negated not with u, but with me. In Koine Greek, you tend to negate indicative verb forms with u, everything else with me. Okay. So this is what they were warned not to do, comma, through another road or another way. This is from anakoreo. It means to flee or depart, withdraw. They withdrew into their own kora, their own region. Okay. So again, grammatically, linguistically, it's fairly straightforward. And again, you see this, again, it's a characteristic of the narrative style, I think, especially the synoptics. Aorist participle, past time indicative. Sometimes you massage them a little bit and you give them a causal or a temporal force. Sometimes you just bang, bang them, you know, piggyback them right onto whatever the main verb happens to be. It's interesting that apparently Herod succeeded in fooling the Magi. Apparently they were going to go back to Jerusalem and tell him what they have found, because they have to be warned in a dream not to return to Herod. Apparently also, I never thought of this, Herod didn't take the Magi very seriously. If he had, he might have said, let me send a few soldier boys along with you.
It's
a very interesting story.
Dangerous area you guys are going into. You need my protection.
And Herod is not shy about killing people that he doesn't like. Right.
The Magi must have really been freaking out by this point.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they give these gifts to this little baby, and then they get an angel talk them through with them. Don't go back.
I know.
It's happening in my life right now.
Well, and you know, maybe just to say at this point, a huge theme in this part of Matthew in general, but also in this story, is human beings do not figure out God's ways of salvation. I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're the scribes or the people in Jerusalem. You can't figure this out. God has to reveal it to you. And that's the only explanation. It's not that the Magi are smart, which again is why it's a little of a misnomer to call them wise men. See? They're not portrayed as particularly smart here. They come to the wrong place. They talk to the wrong guy. They need a star to get them there. And then they have to be warned not to go back and reveal where the baby is. I mean, it's kind of like, it could be Balthazar, Melchior, and Caspar, or it could be Shem, Mo, and Larry.
Yeah, early studies
of Shem. Something like that, yeah. It's actually a wonderful story, and...
a paradox.
Yeah, so one scholar suggested it's an illustration of what Jesus says in Matthew 11. I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and reveal them to babies. See, the Magi are babies.
Well,
Herod and his scribes, they're the wise. But they didn't even know what had happened. So theologically, it's a very wonderful, wonderful text. But we don't want to do theology, because this is Greek club. But we're at the end of a paragraph, and it's 1229. So that's a good place to stop. So next week, I'll be out of town, but Dr. Jeff Oswald is going to lead the way. And... so we're grateful for that. And yeah, good. So thank you very much.